This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 7th of October 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the 104th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. A good mix of stuff in this week's show. Close the windows, clear your mind, turn up the volume, enjoy our offering, friends. Here is What's What. The film critic's film critic will be talking about the role of the critic in a blogger's universe and why his new memoir is called Hatchet Job. That can only be Mark Kermode.
I wanted to love it. I wanted it to be great. 5 minutes in, it was like, oh no, this is hell. He has done that classic thing of he has opened a window on his soul, and it is a gaping abyss of black horror.
We'll check the vital signs of the African art market, who's buying what, why, and where. We'll tell you.
It could have been made in New York or London or wherever in terms of the way it looks. It's contemporary kind of edge, but it's definitely dealing with themes that are relevant to a young West African growing up in a big city.
And we'll speak to the director of Filth, based on the Irvin Welsh novel of the same name. He's John Baird, and it's a ride.
It was just so outrageous. You know, people had said, oh, it's the unfilmable novel, and I've heard a lot of people saying that, and it was almost like red rag to a bull, you know, it was kind of like, okay, let's see if it is the unfilmable novel.
Plus, we're front row as Massive Attack and Adam Curtis's collaborative project moves to the New York Armory. We get back to our country roots in this week's session from the frankly blissful Laura Cantrell, and we'll hear how an abandoned building in Belgrade was transformed into a sonic masterpiece. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So first to our Midori House session, which this week comes from Laura Cantrell, who has both the most and least orthodox backgrounds a country singer could have. She was born and raised in Nashville, but has spent most of her adult life working on Wall Street in New York. At the beginning of this century, she established an enduring cult following with three flawless albums of guileless country, the first of which, Not the Tremblin' Kind, was rated by John Peel, no less, as possibly his favourite album of all time. She's just released a long-awaited new album, No Way There From Here, and she stopped by Midori House to play us a few tracks from it. First up, here she is with Can't Wait.
Hardly ever see you when you're working so hard. Oh, I feel like writing you a little postcard. Thinking about you, darling. It's an old familiar recipe. I know it all by heart, yet it's a mystery. There's a funny kind of push and pull. You leave me wanting more, although my heart is full. I've been getting up early and staying out late. Oh boy, I can't wait, I can't wait, I can't wait. Staring out the window as the shadows grow tall. Pour to these four walls. I can see you coming as the clock strikes eight. Oh boy, I can't wait, I can't wait, I can't wait. No, no, I can't wait, I can't wait, I can't wait.
That was Laura Cantrell with Can't Wait, and we'll have more of the same later on in the show. Now to the very specific world of the film critic. Down the stairs to a Soho basement for a lunchtime screening of This, That, The Other. The great, the good, the usual suspects, dust playing in the projector beam, trying to make notes in the dark, air-conditioned air. And then the magic or the tragic starts and is judged, thank God, for us, so that we know what we might make of our evenings. Mark Kermode's the UK's most recognisable film critic. His empirical styles earned him the nickname The Good Doctor on his massively popular BBC Five Live podcast with Simon Mayo. And his new book, Hatchet Job, lets light in upon the magic of the critic's universe in a timely fashion, asking what the role of the critic is now that we all are. I mean, bloggers. Tom Edwards went to see the doctor.
People really like a good, scathing, pithy, mean-spirited, funny put-down. All those things like, you know, vampires suck, this movie sucks more, Battleship, miss. All those sort of things people remember. And I remember my friend John Norton, who described The Postman as post-apocalyptic Pat. And I just carried that around in my head for ages. It is harder in the end to praise movies than it is to damn them. And if you just fall into the, you know, just being snarky about movies, firstly, you save yourself from any risk, because there's no risk involved in being rude about films. You can be rude about films all, you know, it doesn't matter whether people like the films or not. I mean, that's the really strange thing. People can be rude about a film you like and you still find it funny. But if somebody stands up for a film you hate, it's a strange
then it's an
thing.
Issue.
Yeah. So
let's talk a bit about the sort of broader than the critical faculties, because
sounds like an arts department in a university.
Well, I do my best. There's a sort of a recurring theme almost in the book about the changes of technology. You write about, you know, your first forays into using a fax machine.
Oh, quite Lord, yeah.
But I mean, now we've got the internet. It's good and bad. Obviously, people talk about it. This idea of the citizen journalist. Everyone's a critic. Mm-hmm. There's obviously a bit of a debate about this. As a recognised critic, an established critic, someone whose views people tend to actually pay attention to, how do you feel about this idea that now movies are promoted with, you know, Twitter quotes and this kind of nonsense? You write about it a bit in the book.
Sure.
But I mean, it's a problem, isn't it? It's not edited. There's no real sense of where these people are coming from. Is it a wholly bad development that everyone can have a view and get it out there?
There's been this phenomenon recently of Twitter quotes appearing on movies. You know, the best movie I've ever seen, Sheena from Pudsey. And Andrew Collins wrote in the Radio Times about this. He said, there's no suggestion that Sheena from Pudsey is making it up. The question is, who is she? And what else has she seen? If somebody says, this is the best film I've seen all year, my first question is, okay, what else did you see this year? And if the answer is nothing at all, then okay, of course it's the best film you've seen this year. Why is it that Philip French was the greatest film critic in the English language? He'd been doing it for 50 years. You see that many films. You have a frame of reference that means when you see a new film, you go, okay, well, it's interesting because it relates to that Western that you probably didn't see and that Japanese movie, which you may well have seen. And incidentally, there's a better version of it that's currently being made in, you know, that, okay? So the factual stuff is important. But more important even than that is, what do you have invested in this opinion? Who are you? What else have you seen? And what have you got to lose by saying it? That's my problem with Twitter quotes, is anyone can say anything. And to quote Andrew Collins, who's to know? Anonymity is the scourge of all criticism. The only opinions I'm interested in are opinions to which somebody will put their name. And I need to know, who are you? What have you seen? What, you know, what's your history, and what have you got to lose by saying this? And if the answer to those is I don't know and I don't care, then I'm really not interested in what you're saying.
Let's talk a little bit about, I mean, it's called Hatchet Job, the book. It's basically also about bad movies, ultimately. I just wondered, in terms of some of your favourite serial offenders, if you like, what's your view? I just wonder what your real view of someone like Michael Bay, there's always these jokes about him. Is it possible to make so many bad movies if you're just a bad director? Or is there some kind of warped genius that can deliver something so unappetizing and so infuriating to you? You must have a sense of almost admiration, don't you, for your sort of serial offenders?
Everyone thinks that what I want to do is go on hating Michael Bay forever. Okay, I don't want to hate Michael Bay. Incidentally, I've never met Michael Bay. I'm talking about his work. I have no idea what he's like as a person. There was a weird moment in the case of Pain and Gain when, you know, there was this story that Michael Bay had made an art movie and it was, you know, low budget for him. It's like $30 million or whatever it is. And Mark Wahlberg, who I like very much, and it's based on a real story and it's going to be like a blackly grim kind of, you know, people were talking about Elmore Leonard and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And I thought, great, I'm going to, you know, how interesting to see a Michael Bay film that's going to be good. And I went in and I sat down and I swear, nobody believes me, I swear I went into Pain and Gain with an open mind. I wanted to love it. I wanted it to be different. I wanted it to be great. And I was going, okay. 5 minutes in, it was like, oh no, this is hell. He has done that classic thing of he has opened a window on his soul and it is a gaping abyss of black horror. I do believe that if you're a film critic, you only know what good looks like if you know what bad looks like, you know. And so any idiot can go along and watch Schindler's List and realize that it's important. But it takes a special kind of idiot to realize that Cannibal Women in the Avocado Jungle of Death is important. And, you know, and it is incidentally important. And, you know, Kim Newman always said, he said there's virtually no film he's ever seen that he wished he could unsee because it all adds to the body of knowledge. I mean, people say all the time, I saw Jurassic Park the other day. It was the worst film I've ever seen. No, it wasn't. You want to see the worst film you've ever seen? You come to my house. I will show you the worst film you've ever seen. Believe me, you will crawl out of the door at the end of it.
That's a fairly negative note on which to end. So I'll just ask you one final question very briefly. You write in the book about the perils of actually empowering the public. People often say, oh, actually, there's no need for critics at all. We could just do movie viewings, let the public decide. And there's obviously some celebrated examples where that hasn't really worked out very well. You write about, in particular, a movie that you watched that struck you very much when you were younger, this film Jeremy, and how if you'd had your way, you know, you would have changed it. But actually, it would have sort of almost ruined the character. I'm put in mind of, I think it's Johnny Rotten or Sid Vicious who said, you know, about the man in the street and letting them have their wedding, that he'd met the man in the street. And he was not a very nice person, too shorthand. That's right, though, isn't it? We should stick with... We need critics to inform us, and we shouldn't just listen to the white noise of the man in the street, because they don't really know what they're talking about a lot of times.
Well, look, it's entirely possible. Here's what I think in the end. I think when it comes to movies, filmmakers should make movies and audiences should watch movies. I don't think audiences should say, I like it, because if you change that, I'd like it more. I mean, I always cite that example of Joe Dante saying it got so bad in the 90s that he felt like if he was sitting on set and he'd shoot a scene and afterwards he'd have to turn, there'd be like a sofa full of punters. You go, what do you think? You like it? You like her? You like him? You want him to get, what, do you want it to be science fiction? I can make it whatever you want. You tell me what you want. Because in the case of Jeremy broke my heart. And I love it because it broke my heart. But if somebody had been there and said, do you want to change it? I would have said, of course I want to change it. I want him and her to be together at the end. But that then I wouldn't have liked the film. As far as the you know, do we still need professional critics? My answer to that is yes, but my answer to that is also, I'm saying yes as a 50-year-old man who has been employed in film criticism for 26, 27 years, and I have a vested interest in saying that. And the thing that I want everyone to take away from this is always ask, what have they got to lose? What have they got invested in it? Why are they saying what they're saying? And I say right at the beginning of the book, you know, hey, you may well think this is all rubbish, but bear in mind, this is written by somebody who has a vested interest in hanging on to film criticism. I love this job. I mean, I genuinely love this job. I've never got bored of it. If I could do this forever, I mean, God bless Philip French, right? 80 when he filed his last review. And I look at that and think, you know, that is a trajectory. And he's still writing, incidentally. He's still writing in The Observer every week. And every week you read his column and you go, oh, I wish I'd written that.
That was Mark Kermode talking to Tom Edwards. Mark's book, Hatchet Job, Love Movies, Hate Critics, is out this week, published by Picador, and Mark's currently on tour in the UK. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we now travel to that great continent, Africa. Contemporary art from Africa has been experiencing quite a boom in recent years, fueled by private collectors, galleries and museums. And you only have to glance through Christie's catalogue to get an impression of how that's impacted on the market. Keeping all that in mind, it's no big surprise that this year's Joburg Art Fair in South Africa has been the most successful ever. Leonie March was at the event and met with galleries and collectors to find out what's behind the boom of African contemporary art.
Forget about masks and wooden sculptures. Africa has well arrived in the contemporary art scene, with fresh perspectives, non-traditional aesthetics and cutting-edge ideas. Bomi Odofunade is the director at Dash & Rello, an international art advisory specializing in contemporary art from Africa and its diaspora.
What I find interesting is people experimenting. So performance, say, for instance, sound, video has been a key thing. And conceptually, there's been some amazing conceptual artists come through in the last decade. I mean, I could show you some artists who you could guess they were from Africa, but then I could show you other artists that you'd never know where they were from, but they just happen to be African.
African art in the last decade has become more globalized in both its aesthetics and contents. Large-scale paintings of the Ivorian artist Aboudia, for example, remind me of the works of Jean-Michel Basquiat in their style. Jack Bell, the owner of the Jack Bell Gallery in London, was immediately mesmerized by this young artist.
I came across him during the Ivorian Civil War in 2011. There was a lot of trauma in the work, and it seemed to have an incredible energy. It could have been made in New York or London or wherever in terms of the way it looks, its contemporary kind of edge, but it's definitely dealing with themes that are relevant to a young West African growing up in a big city.
A lot of young, emerging artists were on display at the CS Joburg Art Fair, showing the diversity and vitality of the African contemporary art scene. The fair has grown tremendously since its humble beginnings in 2008, with more galleries, more visitors, and more sales than ever before. On a panel discussion, Ross Douglas, the director of the fair, explains why.
Once again, the Tate Acquisition Committee come, and they have quite a substantial budget to buy African contemporary. If you looked at the Venice Biennale this year, there were 7 African pavilions. The first Venice Biennale I attended was 4 years ago, and there was not one African pavilion. And suddenly, you know, you suddenly feel that Africa has arrived in the contemporary art scene. 10 of the fastest growing economies, 6 or 7 of them on sub-Saharan Africa. So I think that's another reason, is that, you know, with the latest sort of economic explosion of Africa, it's come along with international business people suddenly starting to buy African contemporary.
One of them is Samai Kiyingi, a private collector who also sits on the Tate Modern's African Art Acquisition Committee.
With the Tate, what I'm looking for is the best art being produced by African artists or artists from Africa that will be transformational for the Tate collection. Big names, David Goldblatt, Samuel Fosso, Ellen Atsui, so big international established artists who we felt should be in a global collection such as the Tate.
The Ghanaian sculptor Ellen Atsui is a good example of how this growing international interest has impacted on prices. His artwork, Another Plot, sold for over $1 million at Christie's in New York in May this year. Even the prices of work by emerging African artists, which Samai focuses on in her private collection, are increasing.
It's been quite scary, actually. I remember I saw a piece by a Kenyan artist, let's say, in January 2012, and decided to buy it in December 2012, and it had gone up by about 100%. And that's because of the growing interest in African art. And to be fair, I don't mind, because I do think that African art is quite affordable given the level of quality, but the prices are definitely going up.
Besides private collectors, galleries and museums from across the world, Bomi has also observed a growing interest from the continent itself.
There are a lot of collectors in African art. There's never been not collectors of African art, but no one really has a concise collection of everything. I actually think that a lot of African Americans have most concise collections of African art in terms of contemporary art, and a lot of Europeans as well. It's because they can travel more. So a lot of Africans that live in the country have very good collections, but it's very domestic. So my advisory is the way of bridging, you know, the countries and building a collection that's kind of continental.
It's also a question of infrastructure. There's a lack of contemporary museums and galleries on the continent, which leads to the paradox that many African artists are well known abroad but lack exposure in their home countries. South Africa is an exception in all of these aspects, but still proves to be a challenging environment. Jonathan Garnham runs Blank Projects, a young contemporary art gallery in Cape Town.
In South Africa, you have several serious galleries. You have a whole lot of other galleries, but, you know, proper galleries that represent artists, and, you know, there's under 10 in the whole of the country. The problem is there's a very small market here, you know. People with financial means, quite an unsophisticated, relatively conservative market for art.
Many gallery owners and artists are now hoping that this will change and that the market and the appreciation for African contemporary art in their home countries will follow this international trend. For Monocle in Johannesburg, I'm Leonie March.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're back after this to meet the director of the film that no one thought you could ever make.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
You can be European, meaning reliable, responsible, you believe in democracy and environmental protection and, you know, equal justice. These are all Islamic values too.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
It's not like New York, because New York, it's like you can walk to Central Park, you can walk anywhere you want. There's an urban continuity. In here, you have to get into a car or get into something that moves and get out of here.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we're verging into the realm of autobiography now as we investigate the depraved life of a 30-something man trying to keep it all together in a frankly filthy world. I'm only joking, of course. We turn now to the week's key movie release here in the UK. It's also coming out across Europe this month and will make its way to Japan and Australia in November. Filth, based on the Irvine Welsh novel, is a gothic, surreal, no-punch-pulling, ugly, beautiful tale of a bent copper in Edinburgh who'll do anything to get a promotion. Or is it a tale of drunken, drug-addled degradation? Or is it the darkest love story the screen has to offer? I spoke to director John Baird to see.
Scotland was such a uniquely successful race. This nation brought the world television, whiskey, and of course, me, Detective Sergeant Bruce Robertson.
I think Irvine's writing really attracted me. It was the first book I'd ever read of Irvine's. I read it before any of the others. And it's my favourite book of Irvine's still, after reading all of his stuff. Just because he's such a complex character,
yeah.
You know, he's on so many different levels, he's complex. But I think underneath it all, there's this real dark humour running underneath it, and really that's the heart and soul of Irvine's writing. It comes from a place of comedy, I think. And also, it was just so outrageous. You know, people had said, oh, it's the unfilmable novel, and I've heard a lot of people saying that, and it was almost like red rag to a bull, you know. It was kind of like, okay, let's see if it is the unfilmable novel, you know. Hopefully it's not.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things. There are clearly, I think you could tell without knowing where it came from, that it may be the source material is an Irvine Welsh novel, because it's got that super dark comedy in it. Yeah. There's a gothic element to it, which comes out very much in the styling, the way the film's directed, but the way that the film looks as well, in terms of the styling and the costumes even. And it's obviously an Edinburgh film. And it's sort of peering into the deep, dark underbelly of that city as well. Yeah. What was that like? I mean, that's kind of home turf, isn't it? Were you sort of kicking off the moss on the roof of places that you'd frequented as a kid?
Well, I'm from Aberdeenshire, yeah. Northeast of Scotland, but I studied in Edinburgh for a few years, so I know it very well. I mean, look, all of Irvine's stuff is pretty much based in Edinburgh, apart from actually the sequel to Filth, which is Crime, kind of unofficial sequel, which is in Miami. But yeah, I mean, what I wanted to do with it is because there had been several attempts to adapt the book before, and they all kind of, none of them really got off the ground. And I think where they were going wrong was they were trying to adapt it in more like a social realism sort of way, and like a sort of dark, gritty way. And I thought the way to make us more palatable or followable for an audience is to sort of heighten the sense of reality, you know, make it slightly surreal and big and kind of over the top and a little bit theatrical, fantastical, because there is, you know, and the book is a lot, even is even darker than the film, if you can believe that.
I'd like to talk about how the sort of genesis of the film, because I know that someone else, some other production company had an option on this movie, yeah, and it ran out and I guess the rights went back to Irvin Welsh. Yeah. And then you went out to hang out with him in Dublin and sort of scope out and present your vision of what the movie was going to be. Yeah. That sort of sounds like it might have been fun.
It was, man. It was. It started off at about 9 o'clock in the morning. We got the first flight across to Dublin, and we met him in a bar. But you know, I was expecting maybe coffee or something, you know, quite sensible at that time. But no, it was straight onto the Guinness at 9 a.m. I thought, oh, here we go. So
that's a meeting with a capital M, isn't it?
It was, and yeah. But we just bonded very quickly, and I think Irvin sort of realised what I wanted to do very quickly in terms of, as I said before, like the heightened sense of reality, the comedy, the, you know, the madness to it. And as I said, the guys who tried to adapt it before didn't take that approach. I think there was about 3 or 4 attempts before to do it. It ended up in this legal battle, and I'm not exactly sure what the implications were, but Irvin was very kind enough to give us the rights for pretty much next to nothing. Because he's that kind of guy, you know, he's like, if you respond to his material, if he gets exactly what you're trying to do and he goes with you. And he was such a big help in getting this film made, you know, just by giving his approval to whether it was a script or the cut of the film or whatever it was, you know. So having his name attached to it and his support has been fantastic, you know.
Let's have a little brief chat about about the production design. Yeah. We use the word gothic to describe the kind of look of the movie, which suits its subject matter, I suppose, as well. Mm-hmm. How much of that comes from the book itself? How much of that is you? How much that is Mike Gunn? Because it does have it's the best looking police station, for example. A lot of the action or a lot of the internal action kind of happens in this police station. Yeah. That's got a pretty good look. I wouldn't mind working there weren't for the staff.
I tell you what it was is we just wanted to raise it slightly. We didn't want to make it look like a cop procedural drama. You know, yeah, it would look like The Bell or Target or something like that, by having this 1960s kind of modern building, because it takes you into the realms of the television world. So you want everything to be slightly larger in life than the performances are, the dialogue is, the characters are. So we kind of wanted to go more towards like an American looking building, you know, like something it could look as though it was in Chicago or New York or something, and give it that sort of more cinematic feel, and also to make the audience slightly uneasy with where they were. And because ultimately, it's not that important that Bruce is a policeman. It makes it more interesting with the things he's doing. It's about his inner journey. It's about his psychosis, his madness, and his lust for love, really. I suppose it's like a tragic love story if you really break it down.
Well, that's where the dark comes in, the darkest love story.
Yeah, the darkest love story ever. I mean, hopefully this DVD will come out on Valentine's Day. I think it comes out in...
That's the one.
It comes out in February, the DVD, so...
Darling, they were out of roses, but I got you filth.
I got you filth instead.
And we've alluded to the casting a couple of times before. I said you must have been like a kid in a candy shop with this. James McAvoy plays your lead character. He's absolutely stellar in this. Yeah. And he goes on. He has to fight. He has to go down. He really has to sort of achieve the highest and lowest levels. You've also got, and we can mention a few of the other characters in it, some amazing actors in this film. At what point does that happen? When you know who you've got to come on board? Do you have to woo the actor? Do they have to woo you? How does that work with a part that's so sort of multifaceted?
I think that a big lesson to me was get the script as good as it'll ever be before you show anybody, including Irvin, including any of the actors, financiers, whatever. Because this was a difficult project, as I said, to get off the ground, because there'd been attempts at it before. This was only my second film, blah, blah, blah. So getting back to make the script as good as you can be, and then actors will want to do it, because good actors will want to be in productions that have got rounded characters or something they can do, even if it's a smaller part. I mean, James has gone on record quite a lot to say how he got himself ready for a part, you know, because that was one of our concerns, was that he did look quite young before we met him. And as soon as we met him, we realised how intense and edgy he really is. You know, he operates at a very sort of high level in terms of that. He's a very intelligent guy. For the physical transformation, he actually drank a lot of whiskey to get himself puffed up, you know, and he was drinking whiskey at night before. He wasn't drinking on set, but I hope he wasn't. and drinking the night before just to get a real puffed upness and that kind of angst as well.
Yeah, that's the hungover school of acting.
It's
Do you want to start it? Do you want to go into business?
I think we can make a fortune.
I think we can make a fortune.
but no, the thing about James's as well is when you're on set, like, so when you've got your cast, and I was very fortunate to get a cast, it feels like the great British
cast. It really
does. Yeah, it does. And nobody let me down, and that was a fantastic thing. But when we were on set, James is so professional and he's so technically aware as well. So camera angles, where to be at the right time, he never goes back to his trailer, he's always there. And what that does is not only with the rest of the cast, but with the crew as well, it gives a level of professionalism. He just sets the bar high, yeah? And if he hadn't been like that, we might not have had the film that we've got.
That was John Baird, director of Filth, which is out now across the UK and has worldwide release across October and November. Check out your local listings and see it before dinner. There's a good listener. Still to come in part two, we see what happened when mold-breaking documentary maker Adam Curtis met with trip-hop heroes Massive Attack at New York's Armory. We get all wrapped up in sound of a different sort, fog signals, field recordings and the like, and we'll enjoy more laconic genius from Amadori House sessionista Laura Cantrell. Go somewhere else and you'd be nuts. So first, time to hear more of this week's session. Despite the success of her early albums, Laura Cantrell has been maddeningly sporadic in more recent years. Since 2005, she's released only two albums, both of covers. So her latest offering, which has just been released in the UK, will come as a relief for many, including our very own Andrew Muller, who I think it's safe to say is a bit of a fan. After her session, Andrew sat down with Laura, loaded with a million questions. But first, here she is with Starry Skies.
You're under starry skies and it's all right. Yeah, on your own in the world at night and it's all right. I hope your river's running wide and deep. I know there's a promise that you're gonna keep and it's just fine. Yes, yes, it's all right. City lights, and it's all right. Yeah, streets are done up, Christmas time, and it's all right. I feel the traffic pulling like the tide, and I've got a wind in my sail tonight. It's just fine. Yes, yes, it's all right. When I dream myself to sleep, thinking all those loving things. Don't you know it's just fine? Yes, yes, it's all right.
You recorded this album in Nashville, which, as you said, is where you're from, which is kind of unusual right there, because Nashville's a place country singers go to.
Right.
And you had the advantage, I guess, of being born there, but you could put together probably a quadruple compilation albums of country songs about how awful Nashville is.
You could. That's how tough.
Do you have that love-hate relationship with Nashville, or do you look at it differently because it's where you were from?
I think I do look at it differently. You know, Nashville to me is this wonderful place that has this unique culture and it's a unique music culture. Then there is the commercial industry in Nashville, which is what I think those songs that you're talking about are, that makes it a brutal town. You know, it's a tough ride for a lot of people that come there with a lot of ambitions and dreams. But I've not necessarily ever considered myself part of what would be the commercial country industry. So to me, after having made my Kitty Wells record and realizing like there are many people here who do different things and they're not all trying to be Carrie Underwood or Taylor Swift or even Emmylou Harris and you know, folks like that, you know, there's really room for people to come and do whatever they want. and you have the right and license to do that. So I did find after recording my Kitty Wells record that that was a freeing impulse. And the experience that I'd had of recording at this particular studio, Beach House Studio in Nashville, where Lamb Chop records and Andrew Bird, and they made the last Charlie Louvin records there, Bobby Bear, the great country music Hall of Famer. You know, these are disparate artists and they do different things. And yet they still all felt at home in this environment. And I felt that was a good signal to me that I could do something very straight ahead country if I wanted to. And I could go way off the map and do something strange and arty if I wanted to. And either would be just fine. So I think it landed somewhere in the middle. But, you know, Beach House was a big part of that process too.
And had the songs on this album, did you write them in a burst for the record, or had they been stacking up over that, sorry to harp, but near decade since your last one?
I know. Well, some of them I had had going before I made the Kitty Wells record, but the bulk of the things that I feel are strongest actually on the record I've just written in the last couple of years. And I had done that actually as part of a songwriting group in New York that I'd been participating in. It's not a like workshop type of group, but it's basically some local writers, my friend Kate Jacobs.
This is the Radio Free Song Club.
Radio Free Song Club, exactly. Basically, she's a mom returning to, you know, her rock and roll ways after a few years off, and had called me and some other folks who had had kind of a natural kind of pause in their careers and said, would you like to join me with this, you know, once a month or once every 6 weeks kind of get together where you bring a new song? And at the time I thought, well, that sounds like a lot of fun. And I actually do have a pile of things I haven't finished. So maybe it'll get me, you know, get me going to finish this stuff.
Did you find yourself in assembling these songs though? Was there a particular sort of idea or character that you kept returning to?
I think a lot of them are kind of heart songs, and they're not all love songs, but they are all pretty much about, you know, feelings. And, you know, there's one, the Wash Day Blues, which is sort of about a lady cleaning her house and feeling, you know, upset at the same time and kind of bursting into tears at the washing machine. And then there's some really effusive songs about being excited about another person or about other things. So in some ways, I always hated when after someone would have a child, they would come out with their baby record.
it rarely ends well.
Yes, but, or with their kids' record. But I did feel like being a parent had to kind of open me up in a way. You know, certain things I'd been a little bit reserved about came through more prominently in my writing. And, you know, so it's a little more direct. And if there is a theme, that's what it is to me. It's this kind of more emotionally open, you know, less story songs about people who are dead now, and more songs that could just be, you know, from me to you across the table.
That was Laura Cantrell talking to Andrew Muller. Her new album, No Way There From Here, is out now in the UK and will be out in the US early next year. She's also on tour in the UK now. LauraCantrell.com has all the details. You're tuned in to Culture on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound. With its 5,000 square metre hall, the Park Avenue Armoury in New York is one of the most intimidating places to exhibit art in. But a new show called Massive Attack v. Adam Curtis, first shown at Manchester's International Festival, has succeeded in activating the immense space in a mind-blowing way. The 90-minute performance is a collaboration between one of the few documentary filmmakers that realise they're working in a visual medium, Adam Curtis, and Robert Del Naja from the legendary band Massive Attack. It includes a live performance taking place behind 11 looming screens playing a 90-minute long film and promised to be a sensory overload. Pauline Eiferman spoke to Rebecca Robertson, the Armoury's president and executive producer, to discuss the physical and metaphorical space the show occupies.
I come home in the evenings and I turn on the television to see what's happening, and then as soon as I wake up in the morning, I've turned it back on just to see if anything's changed since I went to bed.
We're standing in what was a drill hall, and it is part of a larger building called the Park Avenue Armory. It was built between 1877 and 1881. It's 55,000 square feet, 85 feet high, and it was built to look like a 19th century European train station, so it's very beautiful. I mean, the design was very specifically done to be kind of European and very attractive with a sort of an industrial flavor to it. So the men who built this armory built it with their own private money. They were the richest men in New York and therefore perhaps America. And they spent a huge amount of money doing this. They didn't just drill in here. And this was volunteer soldiers. This is all men had to carry firearms at that time. So what they really did, they owned land and built ships and they were industrialists. But what they did in here, they did drills, but they also did music and they did ballet and they did theater. And so it's funny because you think of it as a drill hall always having been used for that. But in fact, from its very earliest days, it was used for music.
And this show was actually commissioned by the Park Avenue Armory as well as festivals in Manchester and Germany.
Yes.
Why did you think it was a good fit for this specific space?
So what we do here is we have this beautiful space and we want to use it for art that needs us. So if you want to go to a traditional theater, if you're a director or a writer, don't come to us. We're the wrong place. So we want to do work that is a sort of a new platform. It kind of breaks the mold. So in Manchester, England, and in the Ruhr in Germany, they have spaces like ours. So we have started a partnership where we come together to co-commission works that need spaces like ours and are kind of out of the box.
I seen you digging a hole in your neighborhood. You're crazy, but you're lazy. No need to live in a lean-to. Your troubles must be see-through. See through money like it's paper. With faces I remember. I drink on a daily basis. The whistle calls my temper. It never calls my temper. I'm walking through the suburbs. They're not exactly lovers. You're a couple, especially.
So the show is a video playing on 11 screens, right? And then a performance by Massive Attack behind the screens. What have you noticed the audience doing? Are they dancing? Is this a concert? Or is everyone just looking at the screens? What does it look like?
You know, it's sort of a political treatise on the way the world is treating all of us since the fall of the Berlin War. Massive Attack is very political in their views. And so they and Adam Curtis came together to create this work. It's like a concert in a sense because it's standing, but you're surrounded by all these visual images which are totally absorbing. And then the band comes in support of the particular feeling that they're trying to portray. So trying to get that 70s vibe, then they do some 70s covers and 80s covers. Then of course they also play some of their own things. I think it melds so beautifully together. So sometimes you have people dancing, and sometimes you have people just standing and taking it in, and sometimes people are talking and arguing with each other about what they're seeing on the screens.
When baby, it's you. And this show is 90 minutes long, and there are no chairs, right? Is
there
that a conscious?
No chairs. That is a conscious decision by the creative team. And honestly, we haven't heard much grumbling. It's been great. I think people are very absorbed by what they're seeing, and they're into it. And in fact, we get these fantastic kind of explosive raves at the end of it. So it's a really great crowd every night.
Rebecca Robertson, president and executive producer at the Park Avenue Armory in New York, talking to Pauline Eiferman there. To hear more of what the Armory has in store this fall, visit armorypark.org. And you're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24, Sonic Experimentation. Up next.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monaco.
From Monaco.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monaco.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monaco, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24. Fog Signals, a label set up by a sound art duo known as HowlRound, the old BBC word for feedback, specialise in musique concrète, music in the broadest sense of the word made from real sounds. Their first release was an album recorded at night in the corridors of London's Bush House, home of the BBC World Service for 70 years before it was relocated last year. It featured the sounds of the building manipulated on the ancient tape machines found in the basement studios and was a bit of a cult hit with critics and audiophiles alike. Their latest work, which has just been released, has taken them to Belgrade to sculpt a sonic landscape from the innards of an abandoned building. It's just come out on vinyl, and keen to find out more, producer Katie invited Robin the Fog, one half of HowlRound, into the studio here at Midori House.
I was approached by a company called Kamenzind, which is an architecture magazine which is specifically designed to be read and consumed both by architects and by the people that actually use the spaces that they talk about. It's a magazine where ideas about architecture are discussed, but it's not just for professional architects, it's for everybody. And they were invited by the Goethe Institute in Belgrade to produce a magazine about an area in need of a bit of redevelopment called Savamala. And the idea of the magazine is to change the way you view architecture around you, the local space. And part of that was they wanted to make sound pieces. And on my first day there, two of the magazine's newly arrived staff said, right, well, if you're making sound pieces about Savamala, you have to come to the Spanish House, which is this abandoned building. It's an old ruined customs house on the banks of the River Sava with no ceiling and a flooded basement. And they said, you've got to come and hear it. So we went in and they picked up some spanners and started banging on the structural supports that were poking out of the walls, and it had this incredible echo. It was like something out of a Tarkovsky movie. And so they would sing, they would pitch their voices into the space, and you would hear the echo kind of swirl around the space. It was just the most amazing sound. So I collected lots of recordings and basically just started going through them, sort of looking for the interesting parts and layering them together and cutting them, pasting and playing forwards and backwards and slowing down, and a long time later, out came an album. It was the first time I'd worked in a completely abandoned, ruined space, and I think you get a sense of that abandonment in the record, and I think you also get a sense of how cold it was when we made the recordings.
One of the things I'm intrigued about as someone who's a little bit of a sound geek myself is how you go about gathering sounds like that. What kind of equipment do you take with you? Is it difficult to get certain effects and certain noises from difficult spaces, or how do you go about approaching it logistically?
The thing that always amazes me is how easy it is to sort of create this kind of strange sound world just by using the most basic of sources. On the back cover of the sleeve, you can see the recording equipment. It's one single portable handheld recorder. You know, nothing particularly sophisticated, no specialist microphones. I suppose when you listen to the record, you would maybe assume that it's been put through all these different processes, or it's had lots of computer plugins added to it or anything like that. And the thing is, it hasn't. All you're hearing are the recordings as they were made on the day. They've been slowed down, perhaps. They've been played backwards, perhaps. But all the detail that was there when I hit record is still there. That's the thing I want people to take away from my work. It's just this idea of how easy it is to create genuinely strange sounds with the most basic equipment and the most basic sources.
Tell me about the night that you put on, the launch night in Belgrade, in the building itself.
The building itself has now changed. When we went there, it was a shell. And now it's been transformed into this arts pavilion, and it's had these sort of huts built within its walls, and the walls have been strengthened, and the basement's been closed off and sealed up and all this sort of stuff. It's a building with this tremendous long history, and in the time it took to record those sounds and make them into an album and come back, it had changed again. So it's a snapshot of a period in its time. But they let us come back into the building and play the sounds back into the space. It felt like a homecoming of sorts. I don't know, it felt very fulfilling to be able to bring the sounds back into the building where it had originally come from.
Presumably the kind of natural acoustics and natural resonance of that space maybe added to the sound in some way when you played it back. Was there kind of an extra special quality because it was almost like the building singing it back to you?
Yeah, definitely. And also, as it happened, they've now made a few adjustments to the building and lit it up at night, so it's got this sort of purple ghostly light. It was really atmospheric. It was a very proud moment.
That was Robin the Fog talking to Katie Bill Boa there, and if you fancy picking up a copy of the Secret Songs of Savamala album, just visit thefogsignals.com. And that's just about all we have time for this week. I'm off to Qatar, more on that next week, alongside MIPCOM, Flip Literary Festival's UK offering, and maybe even a taste of the Frankfurt Book Fair. Don't say we don't treat you. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bill Boa, who was helped along the way by the genius Holly Fisher. We've got time for one last track from this week's Midori House session. This is Laura Cantrell with Letter She Sent. Thanks for tuning in.
The day is too harsh, the night is too long, the band on the stage never played her song. The drinks were just wet, she got caught in a net, and she never had an answer to the letter she sent. Donna came home with a bag from the store and her wallet a little lighter than it was before. She spent all she had and a few pennies more. She'll be looking good walking through an open door. The day is too harsh, the night is too long, the band on the stage never played her song. The drinks were just wet, she got caught in a net, and she never had an answer to the letter she sent. Chasing after the night, everything better by morning light. Julie came home with sand in her shoes, and the sun on her skin felt like good news. She's not sure just yet, she's starting to groove. Don't you come around talking about yesterday's blues. Day is too harsh, the night is too long, the band on the stage finally played along. The drinks were all wet, she got caught in a net, and she never had an answer to the letter she sent. Sometimes you never get an answer to the letter you send, and she never had an answer to the letter she sent.